Blog Talk Radio.
And I'm not immune to that. I have weird interracial thoughts about interracial relationships. Sometimes me and Melissa will be walking hand in hand, having a good day. I'll see another interracial couple and be like,
and it may be, and I'm not unwilling to critically look at this. It may be just a personal desire on my part to find a, you know, kind of soothing lotion so it doesn't feel so painful what it is that you're saying. So I'm not unwilling to look at that.
Okay.
And I declare to your listeners that in no way do I see these marriages as being anything other than legal, loving unions, and in no way do I think any of these marriages represent anything tragic. We should all be so lucky to be in relationships with people that love us.
Context of white supremacy, Gusty Renegade. Justice and to share constructive information on the system of racism, white supremacy. The sound clips that you heard to begin the broadcast, going in order, that was W. Kamau Bell, previous guest on the program. He was here March 1st, married to a white woman, suspected racist. The second clip... Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., founder of the White Privilege Conference, married to a white woman.
You have been doing the White Privilege Conference.
Wrong button. And the final clip, Professor Cheryl Judice. She is the author of Interracial Marriages Between White Men and Black Women. All three of those guests have been on the program. Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. should be coming back very soon. Hopefully, as we move forward in this broadcast, you will understand the significance of those clips, and perhaps you will think a little differently about those programs if you check them out. My hope is that you will think a lot about sexual intercourse between white people and non-white people in the context of white supremacy. That is my hope from this broadcast, that you will think about it critically and just evaluate it in a way that you perhaps have not before. Our guest for today's program, he has also been on this program before, fantastic broadcast in February of this year. We discussed his just incredible book, Homosexuality and the Effeminization of African Males. I cannot tell you, it is an extraordinary privilege, an honor. I am incredibly grateful not only to have him on the program once, to have him back again, and to discuss two topics that I think are critical for black people to analyze and have constructive information about. So I'm still a victim of racism, white supremacy for sure, but I feel like I have definitely been spoiled to have him on the program twice. Our guest for today's program, you can check out all of his books at AquabinHouse.com. It's linked in the description. Just click his name. The book we're going to be discussing today, Excuses, The Politics of Interracial Coupling in European Culture, the author and our guest, Dr. Mwalimu K. Baruti. Are you with us, sir?
Yes, I am, and it is so good to be. It's really Gus.
Yes, sir.
Okay,
yes, sir.
Good to be speaking with you again. I also enjoy very much being on the program last time. It was very comfortable. Well, it's always comfortable talking to people who understand what you're talking about. that's always a benefit. So it's good to be back. And this topic is definitely one that needs to be addressed, hearing a lot of the things that are going on in the particular D.C., Baltimore area, but also, you know, nationally, in terms of the mentality that seems to have taken on the next trend in our sub-assimilation and sub-amalgamation into Western society.
Wow. Again, we are super thankful for you sharing a bit of your evening with us. We want to hop right in, cover as much material as possible. You said the last time we were here, always important, declaration of war, anytime non-white people engage in dialogue. When we were here last, we had agreement system of white supremacy worldwide. That system is still in place, correct?
Absolutely. It has not changed at all. It has really, I mean, the question always begs the other question of you know, why would it? Why would they have changed? They have been extremely successful in convincing, and I use that word lightly, but convincing everyone, particularly us, that they are supreme. As you look at the word supremacy, that means that they consider themselves to be supreme. It doesn't have to be necessarily stated in that way, in terms of how they portray themselves in the world, particularly in personal, private affairs, but they are the dominant force, and their opinion and their way is what's ruling the world, and it says something about their maintenance of that and their ability to maintain it when you have the people who you are dominating pushing forth that domination even harder than you are. The interracial thing is only one aspect of it, but it's locked into a lot of things that are really ground in the concept of menticide, where you have, very generally speaking, a people who have been in a position of oppression for many hundred years, if you will. Some people would go so far as to say 2,000 in terms of the assault against African people, but who have been under this assault for so long that they have lost sight of themselves, and they have gained, if you will, a sight of their destroyers as their saviors and as what they most want to be like, and they have as their primary agenda the sub-integration, sub-assimilation, sub-amalgamation into those people. We have been a integration-focused people since we lost ourselves, since we lost our mooring, since we stopped seeing ourselves as African, coming from the African continent, since the establishment of a Negro status quo within our community. We have been very, and I don't like to use the word integrated, because integration means you're doing an equal exchange. We're being sub-integrated. That's evident in so many ways. One of the latest ways was the report that came out talking about the level of wealth, comparing black women and white women. And, of course, that goes back many decades. I was studying that when I was in graduate school. A book by Oliver and Shapiro called Black Wealth, White Wealth discussed that. There was a number of other books that talked about this huge wealth disparity, which has not changed, huge income disparity, which has not changed. In fact, it's worsened. Huge unemployment disparity, which has not changed. In fact, it has worsened also. But when we talk about being a sub-integration-focused people, just to talk about the idea of integration, people, well, I don't think any sane people or any sane person wants to be or aspires to be something that is less than them, something that is inferior to them, something that will turn them into something that's not as great or powerful or smart or what have you as they are. When you talk about assimilation, you talk about adopting the characteristics or becoming a part of or moving in next door to something that you consider to be better than you are. You know, their ice is crunchier, or their cars ride smoother, or their books are better, their teachers are better, their degrees are better. And that means that you, whether it's at a conscious or subconscious level, see that as superior to what you have because you want to be a part of that. You see that as better than what you have. That is your goal. We were the ones who were fighting to move into, they weren't fighting to move into our neighborhoods. We were fighting to move into their neighborhoods. We were fighting to have their children sit next to their children as if by osmosis somehow that their genius would fall into our children's laps somehow. So the idea of us wanting to be integrated, and we're the only people that have that aspiration. Perfect examples are the Latino community in Florida. When they came, They tried to get into the golf clubs and into the other, you know, important things that were part of the city, and white folks repelled them, and they created their own. They said, cool, no problem. They just created their own, and now they have an empire, if you will. In Chicago, you said, find the same thing going on with the Asians, and, well, also the Cubans there, but the Asians also, where they came in and they wanted to get into the white folks' golf clubs, and they wanted to get into the, you know, the elite clubs and all the rest of that, and the white folks rejected them. And they said, okay, no problem. And they went and built their own, and now it surpasses that of the Europeans. We are the only people who are still begging. We are the only people who see white people or Europeans as our identity. Many of those of us who are going back to Africa, we're not going back to Africa because we want to associate it with Africa. In fact, many of those who are going back are using the we're all human rationale as an excuse to be the forerunners of the Europeans who are going to be following them by saying, well, we all originate on the African continent, therefore we're all Africa, therefore Africa belongs as much to Europeans as it does to African people. So we have this drive, this driving mentality, this political philosophy, this unconsciousness, if you will, about ourselves that has us driving ourselves toward these individuals, because at the hands of these people, we were destroyed culturally, socially, disconnected so much from who we are and what we are. No, I'm not using it in the same way that E. Franklin Frazier talks about it in terms of there's no connection between African people and no remnants of African culture remains with us. That's obviously not true. But we've been so separated and so turned against who we are, it's evident in so many ways that the only other option for self-dignity, for pride in people, for a sense of self, for a sense of having some degree of power, is to become them. And if you can't become them, then to be loved by them. And if you go back and over time, you see that there's been a progressive movement toward these final results, if you will, and everywhere there has been this fight toward this sleeping with the enemy. That has been a major part of our agenda, a major part of our celebrations has been to be in their presence, in their neighborhoods, in their bedrooms. Anywhere they are, we want to be. Sadly, the Jonestown thing is one of the most tragic examples of we will... Wherever they go, we want to be. Whatever they say, we'll follow. We need that love and attention and validation from them so bad. So the what I call interracialism, this drive to sleep with the enemy, and most people really don't understand. This has been going on for a long time. We're acting like this is new, and it's just because more it's sort of taken off on this public thing where the books are coming out and the interviews are coming out and the debates are coming out about this, but this has been going on for quite a long time. You look at a lot of the quote-unquote leadership within our community, a lot of the names who are supposed to be people who we held up or hold up as honor and in terms of esteem relative to who we're supposed to be, they were sleeping with the enemy. This is not new. It's just something that because it has taken on such a public notoriety at this point in time, it needs to be the side, if you will, or the perspective of the ancestors that says something is tragically wrong with this in terms of our minds. It needs to be brought up and addressed so that people can have a better way, a more balanced way to look at this. The same thing with homosexuality. As long as we have been in their presence and under their domination, then that's been a small, very minor, really insignificant part of our community. Only now that it has become a public thing and the assault is on, that people are becoming aware and alarmed about it.
Again, a pleasure, I guess, for today's program, Dr. Mwalimu K. Baruti, author of Excuses, Excuses, the politics of interracial coupling in European culture, among other titles, many other titles. Again, you can check out all of his work, AkilBenHouse.com, linked in the description for this program. If you could, because I put it in the description that upon reading your book, your conclusion, non-white people who pursue sexual intercourse with white people under conditions dominated by the system of white supremacy are suffering from menticide, and I believe you already shared that with us today. Could you, I just wanted to make sure for folks who maybe have not read your book addressing that or who are not familiar with Bobby E. Wright, could you give us like a real nice explanation of menticide?
Oh, Bobby E. Wright was a master. He was a master teacher, major scholar, warrior scholar for us. In fact, I have an article on him in the book Menticide, because menticide is a term that he coined. People need to know the importance of this man, because I've often been asked, well, how do you know who the, you know, the real leaders are? These are the ones who suffered for us. These are the ones who died for us. These are the ones who gave away all the fame and fortune and all of the things, the perks that go with that in order to work for us, and they seriously critiqued white supremacy, European culture. Bobby Wright, along with Esther Wright, Easter Wright, his wife, they opened up the first free clinic for blacks in South Chicago. And in fact, his wife is running. He's now one of our ancestors, and he wrote a number of essays which were compiled in a book called Psychopathic Race and Other Essays. And he defined menticide in as a mental disorder among African people who is menticide is a process. It's like suicide, fratricide, homicide, pesticide. Side means to kill. That the suffix side means to kill. So menticide means to kill. Would just plainly speaking would mean to kill the brain. But what he was talking about is it kills the African in you. It kills the way you think as an African person. It kills your self-perceptions. It kills your ability to think as an African. And in its place, it puts in a European brain, but not just, I mean, a European way of thinking, a European mind, but not just a European mind. It puts in a European mind that is the European perception of African people. So it's not a mind that essentially turns you into a European. It's a mind that makes you desire to be that and to elevate that above anything else. He also said, he made this point very clearly, that this is an institution enforced and programmed process. So whatever the institutions that are in the community of the people who have menticide committed against them, the institutions of that, in that people's community, the educational institution, the political institution, the economic institution, the religious institution, the familial family institution, even the military, assuming that they have one, which we don't, institution in those communities, in that community, they must be controlled by those people who are committing menticide against them in order to ensure that this process, this socialization process, occurs properly and that these people are effectively turned against themselves and don't even recognize themselves when they look in the mirror in terms of a cultural mirror or social mirror. So menticide is the process of not just being brain dead like a zombie. It's the process where you actively engage in thought processes that move you in a direction that's harmful to you and your people in service, as Amos Wilson said, in service to white supremacy. This is a very critical concept, and I talk about it all the time because it's one of those terms that we need to bring back. It somehow got lost, I say, in the sauce somewhere, but it needs to be brought back because it's very descriptive of how people are acting and how people are thinking in our community, and we've taken it to a whole new level. But Bobby E. Wright is greatly to be credited with that analysis. Kobe Cambone in three of his books, he has the term called cultural misorientation, which is very, very similar to that, and it connects, or in a sense, it's the disconnection of the African mind is also from the African spirit that exists in the universe of us. And Kobe Cambone explains that exceptionally well. A lot of people have a number of explanations of that. One of the people who I really appreciate, I lost his name for a second there. He uses the word, what was I just saying, zombie, to describe what has happened to us in terms of the way that we act and the way that we are thinking and the way that we're operating relative to European culture and European people. So menticide to me is very descriptive, and you don't know it. It's just like when Bobby Wright talked about the psychopathic racial personality. It's not evident from looking at someone. You can't look at an African person and see that they're mental. Well, in many ways you can, but there are people who are menticidal who are disguised in mud cloth and cowrie shells and Adinkra symbols and locks. So menticide is not something that is always visible. And a lot of times people who are walking around with shirts and ties on and suits on aren't who they appear to be. I say one of the major supporters over the years of this institution and what we do, you would never know from what you see them in. So when we're talking about, and just to bring this full circle, when you talk about this interracialism, then at its base is our menticide, because we still see someone else as more beautiful or more handsome than us. We still see someone else as more desirable than us. At the same, this menticide also not only works in terms of you being attracted or wanting to look like or wanting to be these other people, it makes you turn against your own. So you have this battle that has raged and increased and been fueled in the media and in the schools and in the churches, this divide between African men and African women and this name-calling that has been going on not only between each other but within the two groups. And nothing good can come out of this. If you have a child and you spend the first 5 years of that child's life calling him stupid and making him think that he's the dumbest creature on the planet, then that child, because you're validating that child and you're feeding that child and that child believes that you are really the definition of love, then that child comes to believe that they're stupid. So if we're walking around calling each other B's and N's, thugs, pimps, all the rest of this, just having a conversation here in class last night, the most popular selling books in the black bookstores that are successful still, for the sisters, it is the romance novels, which are essentially porno. And this is creating a certain type of mentality relative to what they should do and what men expect. And for the men, the most popular selling books are the ones on how to be a pimp, how to get all of these women. These are the most popular things selling in our community. So how naturally are we supposed to approach each other when that's what we believe in this Machiavellian mentality that has grasped our culture, that has grasped our community, that this is the way that we're supposed to act toward each other? So then you have the idea, which I heard from a number of women, particularly in my mother's age group and the age group that I was growing in, that white men are such gentlemen and white women are such ladies. So this lie, this fabrication has been pushed forward, and these two things have worked side by side through time, along with within the context of that sub-integration focus, where they're better and we're worse. So why would you aspire to be with something that is inferior? You would aspire to be with something that is superior. It's always amazing to me how science will flip-flop back and forth on the same theory depending upon what it's talking about. Sociology is pretty much understood that choices are socialized, that people decide on who they're interested in based upon variables in society. People who marry each other tend to be in proximity with each other. They tend to live in the same neighborhood, come up in the same community, or go to the same college or what have you. They tend to be of the same socioeconomic status. But when it comes to interracial stuff, it's just that we're all human and we just fell in love. And my father, in his special way, trying to make me understand, he and I'm going to paraphrase what he said the way I would say it, and it's like, love may be where you find it, but culture determines where you're going to look. It determines what you look like. I gave the example when I was teaching college, where if you take somebody to a party and you go down into the room where the party's at and you blindfold this person and you tell him to point out his finger and you spin him around a few times, and whoever he's pointing at when he takes off his blindfold, that's not necessarily the person he goes after. He's going to go after whatever it is that fits within his socialized definition of beauty. That's the person he's going to approach. That's the person he's going to talk to. And the definitions of beauty in Western society all reflect the European ideal. And even when the society becomes more lewd, more extremely sex-focused, then those qualities that are seen as being sexy, like having a behind, like having some breasts, like having some lips, suddenly all of the white characters that you see on television have somehow gotten these characteristics, but they're still white. But now suddenly they have full lips, like African folks. Suddenly they have a behind, like African folks do. Somehow they suddenly have breasts, like African women do. But it's not because these things are seen as a basic quality, if you will. They're because this drive for sexual conquest has been taken to a whole new level, and these are supposed to be indicators of someone who you want to have sex with. So they have followed this, not because they're trying to follow a black model, but because black women are seen as loose within the white community at the base level, whether we're talking about conscious or subconscious. And these characteristics are associated with that looseness. Of course, we know, Rosie Milligan did a beautiful job of explaining that, where the opposite of that applies or has historically applied within our community. What brought that change about in terms of a movement in that direction was the competition from white females. And they begin to do things that white females would do, which historically in our community we understood. It's like, I think I mentioned this last time, you know, several generations ago, we considered ourselves to be sexually the moral superiors, if you will, of European people. We didn't approach it in a arrogant sense of supremacy, but we understood ourselves to be more conservative, more morally connected to sexual behavior, and we understood that Europeans weren't, because they wouldn't do anything, especially European females. But now it's reversing itself, and it's reversing itself in a reactive thing. So we can't sit here and use that I just fell in love philosophy. There's an importance in the package that people come in. There are things that people are socialized to believe are of greater quality and greater desirability than other things. And if we want to doubt that, all we have to do is to go to different societies and different cultures at different points in time and see that different types of women were seen as more attractive, different types of men. In fact, you can just look through American society and the media. You can go back to a time where large breasts and large behinds and white women were seen as very desirable. You can go back to the Marilyn Monroe day, and you went from there to Twiggy. And then that became the most desirable thing, and everybody's walking around trying to be anorexic because socially that was defined as being the most beautiful, and now it is returning full circle back to that, and in fact even worse than that. So we can't walk around talking about I just fell in love. And, you know, there are several points to me that are related to that. We hear that word integration, and because we don't recognize that this is a process, that we are being brought into this society and culture in a particular way, we don't understand that integration is a code word for amalgamation. Chancellor Williams, John Henry Clark, Doc Ben, a whole group of scholars who, interestingly, these movements have taken off since they've gone. It's as if these men and women who were able to articulate and explain the difference between us and our oppressors in a way that allowed us to see and understand us in all of our glory. Once these individuals made their transition, then this movement, this homosexualizing movement and this interracialism movement took off, because the greatest speakers for us, the greatest defenders for us, had made their transition, and now no one's could come in and begin to speak as if they were the authority. So during the time of those individuals, Bereshanga also, they understood that integration was simply a code word for amalgamation, and this amalgamation was part of European military strategy over time. Everywhere that these people went, they immediately created a group of mulattoes. They immediately raped the women and produced a group of children, and they raised these children, most of them, as their own, and they gave them more power or power over or more influence in terms of decisions than they gave to other blacks, and they set these people up as a buffer class, a buffer group. So when the people of color went off, their rage ended up being, in many cases, directed toward this mulatto buffer group. Some people argue now that Europeans recognize, Andrew Hacker talked about this in Two Nations, recognize that it's over, that they are losing this battle, and they don't want to die. So what they are doing at a global level, because it's not just here in this country that that's going on, at a global level, they say go to the malls in South Africa, Azania. When I was in the UK last year, they didn't say that locking the boys up was the biggest problem, even though mothers were crying left and right and fathers felt, you know, powerless. They said the biggest problem in the UK is the interracialism, the black males in particular chasing the white females. Hmm. That's the biggest problem. So it's not just here. This is a global phenomenon. And logically, knowing that things don't happen by accident, we have to, and we put that together with the fact that they recognize that people recognize who they are and what they have done and what they continue to do, then it's logical, looking at this strategy, just like you can also understand regentrification, because whenever they feel threatened, they create forts, and they're creating forts out of these cities where they can come and protect themselves and keep everybody else out. If you put those factors together, then you can see clearly that they are trying to create a global buffer class that will protect them. That's one analysis. Chancellor Williams talked about that very well in the destruction of black civilization. So this amalgamation serves a political, military purpose, political, military, economic purpose for them. And, of course, it's not us that are making the decision. This is them allowing this to happen. This is black males asking white females to marry them is not something new. What is new is white females saying yes. And there's another aspect of that, and then now the move to get black females to go out with white males. The African proverb, if they come and get your men at night, they'll be back in the morning to get your women. That's the first thing that comes to mind when I think about that. But we have to look at the idea, the image of black females in the eyes of European males and what they imagine themselves or see themselves as getting their hands on. The creation of this buffer class is very evident all over. And the question, which I think is very important for people to bear in mind, and it's one of those mark my word statements where you're not going to see this coming to fruition for probably another decade and a half, where this process comes to a screeching halt, because they're not going to allow this to go but so far. No matter what the scientists are talking about with the melatonin and Europeans trying to ingest that and become part of that, the majority of the white population is not going to play this game. The majority of the white population understand that you are creating a buffer. The majority of the white population believe very much in the supremacy of European people, whatever level of consciousness we want to say it at. So this is going to be going on in like a frenzy, but it's not going to last that long because you can't have an extremely large buffer class that can overrule the white supremacist power majority. A great example of that is in Haiti with what was going on in Haiti and the Haitian Revolution. When the mulattoes were given too much power, then the white majority that had created and had controlled through legislation and through economic opportunities and through employment opportunities and through the granting of specific lands and political positions, they had created this group to protect their interests from the blacks. They were the ones who were the primary controllers of the blacks, at least on a major part of the island. When these mulattoes decided that they wanted to flex their muscles, when they decided that they wanted to be in charge or to control the situation themselves, then you saw exactly how the Europeans felt about them. No, that's not what you're here for. You're here to provide a buffer to protect us from them. You have a place. You have a role. We have created you for a reason. We have created you just like we created the Negro. We created the Negro because we needed somebody to control the community and to be in charge of extracting resources from that community for us. So this is a European creation. Now, the people who are being produced in these relationships, their loyalty is not to African people for the most part. And I have met some who are. But for the most part, their loyalty is not to African people. Their loyalty is to this idea of America. And this idea of America is a European construct also. This is their place, their power. They control us. I don't care how much we want to play with. This is ours. There is no institution here that we make decisions in of significance relative to the decisions of the country. We don't make those decisions. Even when we pretend to, it's because the individuals who we have, if you will, voted into power, they're making decisions that Europeans would have made anyway. So they know the particular role that they're supposed to play relative to African people. So that, to me, is one of the major theories that people need to look at and think about. It's interesting, when Europeans went to colonize the African continent, and most of the colonizers were European males. European females did not come with them. I want to say period, but really for the most part. They did not come with them. They left their women at home. What happened on the continent, though, that these guys begin to get concubines and women on the side, and some of them even married some African women, brought them back as African. Of course, this is a very insignificant number, but it was enough to alarm the white females on the European continent, particularly in England and in France, that the small pool of quote-unquote quality males that they have, some of them were being taken by African women. They instituted laws that made it a felony for a white male to be married to someone who was not a citizen of that country. So that eliminated African males because of that threat for that. So we have to ask now why this great movement of white females to take black males. Well, there are a lot of parts to that. To me, the most important, and it's not the black stud thing, even though that's a variable in there, it's an economic thing. There are a shortage of males on this planet. There are a shortage of Asian males. There are a shortage of Hispanic males. There are a shortage of European males. There are a shortage of African males. There are a shortage of males of all groups on this planet. It's more obvious to us because the nature of racism and oppression has removed more and made fewer of us into, or allowed fewer of us to become quality males. So we talk about the prison system. We talk about the homosexualization of males. We talk about those males who want to be playboys all of their lives. We talk about those who are incarcerated. We talk about those who really, you know, essentially never grow up, never take on the responsibility, still remain baby boys, all the rest of this. So as well as just the killing, outright killing, and drugs, and all the rest of that. So the shortage in our community is even more extreme. But as I said, there's a shortage of all males. There's a shortage among white males, and there's an excess of white females. White females, more than, maybe I shouldn't say more than any other group, but they are aggressively more aware than any other group in the country that it takes two to tango in this economy, and it's increasingly taking two to deal with this economy. You have to have the man and the woman in the home bringing in income in order to survive, as well as the protection component, but it's mainly an economic component. So this allows them, which it has happened before, this allows them, because they are seen as the most beautiful, because they are seen as the most desirable, because they, and I haven't met anyone who has told me otherwise, tend to be the most aggressive in terms of hunting down males, because of these characteristics, then they are the ones who are able to pick and choose from those males who have the potential or who are actually bringing in this type of income. There's an interesting statistic that I think helps to bring this to light. In terms of who marries who, black males who marry white females, they tend to marry socioeconomically down. They marry women who don't have the same, you know, credentials, don't have the same income, don't have what they have. White males who marry white females tend to marry down women who have lower incomes. Well, it's a power equation in a patriarchal society. Also, black males who marry black females tend to marry down in that same equation. The only group that absolutely does not apply, for the majority does not apply, is for white males who marry black females. Because the black female, being the least desirable female in this country, has to bring even more to the table, has to have a greater amount of economic or degree or human capital, if you will, when they come to the mating game than any other group of women when they're dealing with white males. So what's going on now, and I guess I'm transitioning now, what's going on now with this movement to convince, and very well convince, and this is not new. Essence Magazine has been about this since the 80s. This is not new. It's just, this is becoming something in the fore because it's creating a public discourse. But black female magazines have been pushing this for quite a while. The problem is going to happen is that you have, within our community, the problem is going to happen, you have so many more black females who are receiving college degrees than black males. Black females are seen as less threatening in the labor market, so they are able to get better jobs than the black males are with similar degrees. That does not mean that the triple disadvantage for black females, being black, being poor, and being female, do not work against them to a greater degree than any other females. But the changes in the income structure, particularly in the labor market, are reflecting something that we're going to see in, you know, 6 or 10 years relative to these changes. It has been since the, you know, way back when, in terms of the ranking of income, white male, white female, black male, black female. It is changing. And at the college level, at the level of having a college degree, not a master's degree, not a PhD, but a bachelor's degree, and not below that, at the level of the college degree, black women are, the ranking is white male, white female, black male. So there have been some substantial changes in there that are going to make this very easy to occur. It's going to make or has made African women in a position where they have become more attractive to white males, because white males recognize that it takes two to tango. They recognize that here's a group of women who sees them as extremely desirable. How many times have I heard Oprah talk about this gorgeous hunk of a white guy on her show? So these females who are seeing white males and have seen white males as most desirable in terms of their looks, in terms of their economic potential, in terms of their, in the stereotype, not beating on them, in terms of the stereotype, them not leaving them, this is going to really create a lot of children whose loyalty in no way, shape, form, or fashion is to African people, and who will be claiming this biracial, triracial, quadracial, whatever. We still have to understand that this is a one-way process. When they instituted the multiple category listing in the census for what race you are, the people who were trying to define themselves out of being black weren't trying to define themselves out of being white, even though they couldn't fit into that white category. They were trying to define themselves as being not black so that they wouldn't have to be looked at lower level. They could fit somewhere in between. We find that as a historical commonality among people who are biracial and get to a level of political awareness where they understand that their middle racialness, if you will, allows them to be elevated closer to those people who they love and who validate them. We also have a variable of the drive for difference. This is one of the things that has been instrumental in driving the homosexualization of many African children, where this society promotes that generation gap and promotes the idea of individuality to the point of extreme difference. So anything that deviates from what has been the norm or what has made sense in the past, anything that does that, you have to, in order for you to be an individual, in order for you to be seen as somebody special, you have to be something completely, totally different from that. So the homosexualization thing came from this idea of a standardized heterosexual thing, which was supposed to be old, passé, outdated. This was supposed to be the new thing. And now, with this drive to be different, the goal among so many people within our community who in Mentasa were working very hard to separate themselves from African people anyway, the goal has been to find friends and to be in relationships with anyone except what had been understood and accepted and reasonable within our community. And, of course, the logic there is flawed, too, because at the same time they want to say that there are a zillion cultures on the African continent, and they're not cultures. They're ethnic groups that have one culture, and that culture is African. This flies in the face of the fact that you have so many different cultures in African so many ethnic groups in African among African people, which they want to claim as cultures. But they want to move to meet somebody who is completely different from them, to find somebody to be with who is completely different from them. And there are many fewer European ethnic groups, if you will, which they're calling cultures, than there are African. But we're driven not to seek out the friendship and the alliances of people who are on the continent, from any of the different countries or different ethnic groups there. We're driven to find alliances and relationships with people who look the exact opposite of us. That drive for difference is really working very well with this drive to be sub-integrated with European society. There are so many variables here. I want to say that it's not funny. And we have to be very careful when we're making blanket statements or trying to understand this in just simple terms. We're hearing arguments that really make no sense in the other direction. I remember somebody, when I was writing the book on homosexuality, listening to people make the argument that people who had issues with homosexuality, they were really closet heterosexuals. And that argument became really big in the community and very big in academia. But somehow everybody forgot to make the argument that homosexuals who have problems with heterosexuals, which is a very prominent phenomenon, particularly in places like Atlanta, there was no argument made or publicized that people, homosexuals who have problems with heterosexuals, are really closet heterosexuals. So we have to listen very careful to the arguments that are being presented, and especially thinking about them in the inverse or the reverse of what's being said, to see if they see if it's really making sense to us. There is also, and I'll make this one last point. When the, in terms of it being a military strategy, one of the things that the Western military is known for and does really well, and when I look at the military, I'm talking about them as a people, as a nation. They always emphasize during times of actual physical combat, that's a declared war, an excessive number of casualties on the other side. And they particularly broadcast this to the soldiers on the other side as a demoralizing effort. So if you feel that more of your people are dying at the hands of your enemy, then you're going to lose some of your drive to be a soldier in this war where you may die knowing that you're losing. So the same thing is going on here relative to this interracial thing where the media is making it appear that it's much larger than it is. And, of course, that's going to drive it to be much larger. But that's giving those people who are involved motivation to continue to expand this, and giving those people who have issues with it, understandable issues with it, is making their arguments appear weak when they are extremely strong.
Again, tremendous honor to have our guest for today's program, Dr. Mwalimu K. Baruti, author of Excuses, The Politics of Interracial Coupling in European Culture, and many other titles. And please go to his website to pick up all of his books, AckelmanHouse.com, the Earl again, AckelmanHouse.com. If you're listening here at Blog Talk Radio, just click his name, take you right to the webpage, and you can pick up all of his extremely important works. I wanted to double check. I think my co-host is here. Justice, if you're there and you have some questions you would like to ask Dr. Baruti, your mic is open. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hello. How you doing?
Doing fine.
Good.
What media would you recommend for kids to learn and understand white supremacy?
Wow. That shouldn't be a hard question, but it is. What I'm doing right now is I'm walking to my bookshelf, and I'm pulling off a book that I wrote called The Sappho. And in The Sappho, because the first medium I'm going to say is to read. That's going to be the first thing. Of course, I know that there are other mediums. In A Sappho, I have some reading lists, and these reading lists have for different ages. Now, my question for you would be, Justice, how old are you?
10.
You're 10 years old? Okay. Well, I'm going to, I'm going to suggest a few books for you, if you don't mind. One of them is by a guy named S.E. Anderson, and it's called The Black Holocaust for Beginners. Another one is Anthony Browder's Nile Valley Contributions to Civilization. Another one is written by a guy by the name of Ariel Robertson, and the name of his book is The Ma'afa and Beyond. That's an extremely important book. Of all of the books that I am recommending, that's probably the most important one of the books, Ariel Robertson's The Ma'afa and Beyond. And it's kind of hard to find, but if people go to www.bookfinder.com, it's like a huge search engine for books. Find books in Australia, Germany, Nicaragua, everywhere, and search the Maafa and beyond on there, and I'm sure that you will be able to find a copy of that extremely important book. I'm going to also suggest, and you sound intelligent, so I'm going to suggest one of my books, which is maybe a little bit difficult to read, but if it's read slowly, and I'm a slow reader, so that's nothing to be feel bad about if you have to read something slowly in order to get understanding. But one of my books that I wrote called Kebuka, and Kebuka talks about the middle passage. We have to understand the process by which we got here and how that benefits other people. But more than anything else, I'm going to highly recommend the RBG site. There's a brother who has hundreds and hundreds of videos and presentations by John Henry Clark and Francis Cress Welsing and Charcy McIntyre. He has the greatest of our revolutionary speakers all in, you know, short clips. Sometimes they're speeches, sometimes 5 minutes, sometimes a half an hour, usually not much longer than that, where you can go to this site and you can just start going through these videos. And these people who are master teachers, they can explain it. Now, the reason I'm not sending you to one particular source, number one, because you're young, I'm very pleased to hear your age and to hear your interest, because most folks who are at your age, except for the students at our school, aren't interested in that question, and they should be interested in that question. But the question that you're asking is going to take you some time to really understand the nature of white supremacy. It's sort of like those things that you have to, or like in math, you have to do these problems over and over again for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks or 2 or 3 months before it really clicks why it makes sense. But you had to do all this work in order to get that. That's the same with white supremacy. There are so many things that you have to understand, and the quickest way, if you are a visual person, is to go to the RGB Scholar. If you can't find it, then if you're on Facebook, connect with me or email me, and I'll connect you with him. I can go through your parents if that's what makes sense, and I can connect you with him, and he's very good at organizing lectures and topics and discussions and debates in such a way that someone who is not aware can slowly be introduced, and then they can pick up speed as they're ready to do that. And then, now there's also well, that's not really in print now. Well, there are numbers. Send me an email or connect with me on Facebook, and I'll send you what I know, and the people who I know, and who can give you guidance on that question. Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you mind if you all of the books that you named, do you mind if you send them to me, like type them up in an email?
Oh, absolutely. That's easy work. That's the easiest work in the world. You just connect with me, and I will be more than glad to do that. And in fact, I might send you too many, but I'll be glad to do that.
Okay.
Okay.
At the end of the show, I'm going to show my email address. So.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Brother Gus knows how to get it to me, because I'm not online right now, but he knows how to get it to me. And I promise you I will do that before, and I usually don't break my promises. I promise that I will do that to you. Today is Wednesday. I have class all day tomorrow with the students, and most of Friday. I will get that to you by Sunday at the latest. Okay?
Okay.
Okay.
That'll be all for now.
Okay, you take care.
Okay.
Context of white supremacy, Gusty Renegade Justice, and our guest, Dr. Mwalimu K. Baruti. Man, always an honor to have you on the program, sir. I'm looking at your book. I have some specific questions I want to ask from the book to kind of share with our listeners, because this particular topic, it pops up all the time. I would say generally it pops up in any discussion on racism, white supremacy. The sexual aspect tends to follow, and it comes up routinely on this program. In your book, Excuses, page 25, you said that racial oppression or oppression period does not require a distance between the perpetrator and the victim. You can sleep every night with another you racially exploit. In fact, racism works best in intimate, personally controlled environments, and even better when the victim believes the racist is not racist. Can you kind of break that down for our listeners?
I don't think that I can do it as well as Francis Cress Welsing did, but I can try. I really don't think that anyone has done it as well as her in the ISIS papers. Right, Africa also did a good job with that. It's, I guess a good example of that is a relationship where there is a child who's being physically abused. I don't mean spanked, of course. I mean physically abused, badly abused by a parent or an adult that is their guardian or is responsible for them. And this child believes that this is love. So that child, after a while, because children like attention just like adults like attention, because this is the person that they're getting their attention from and they want this attention, they end up doing things, and this is documented, they end up doing things that cause the abuse. They end up, they tend to work toward doing things that irritate that person. I shouldn't say irritate like it's the child's fault, but move that person to be violent towards them because they interpret that violent act or the abuse toward them as a form of love. The man who abuses his wife, excuse me, the adult male who abuses his wife, because I don't put that in the category of being a man, the adult male who abuses his wife, his spouse, it's easier for him to do that when he's got her under their roof. It's easier to do that when that's in a controlled, confined environment. It's difficult for him to do that if she's living with her mom or she's living on the other side of town or whatever. It's easier to do when the person is within reach. Now, when we talk about racism within that context, the people come into the relationship with particular stereotypes, with particular understandings. And as long as those stereotypes or particular understandings that work against African people are in place, then the person who is there enjoys the benefits of them. And so if the white female, sexually crazed white female, wants a black male stud to be with her, then this guy who she married, as long as he's performing in this way, then you have racism at work there. You have right within that immediate relationship, a control that is race-based, that works within the context of race. In a very interesting way, it's hard to talk about that outside of the context of menticide, because people, when they think about racism, they often think about it in terms of violent actions against somebody. But for somebody to see you because you are the most beautiful thing on the planet, because you have white skin, regardless of the fact that you weigh 340 pounds and have, you know, a serious mustache and, you know, a carpet on your back, it doesn't make a difference to that individual because their menticidal thinking, which is a creation of a racist system, has that individual actually seeing you as being extremely beautiful because of the color of your skin. That's it. That's the extent of it. Okay. The control of the mind, what you listen to, what you eat, how you raise your children, how you talk, how you teach your children to speak, what you find acceptable in your spouse, in your relationships, what you do with your money relative to her family. Because it's interesting, most of the stories and most of the conversations I've had with people where you had a black man married to a white female, the bulk of the economics that went outside of that immediate family went to her family. It didn't go to his family. It went to her family to support them with their education, to support them with building their deck, to support them with repairs on their cars, to support them with a loan or what have you for their house or what have you. It didn't go to his family. It primarily went to her family. So the loyalty is with her. The loyalty is not with his family, it's with hers. And also, you got to think, this is the person who you share everything with. This is the person who you have the deepest level of loyalty to, which means you have loyalty to her people, which means that because you are sleeping with this person, you are willing to kill one of your own to protect her. You are willing to hurt African people in order to protect this white female who is with you in your house, in your room, in your space. That is menticide, where you will defend the women, someone else's women, before you will defend your own women. And that is always operated within, you know, a very proximate, close-up situation and a close relationship with other people. And it's not a matter of, again, that word control always evokes in people's minds, you know, violence and battering and beating and all the rest of that. Psychological warfare is the major component of menticide. Psychological warfare is the major component by which we are controlled. Psychological warfare is the major component through which genocide is occurring among us. Because increasingly the major form of genocide, as Amos Wilson talked about, other folks talked about, black-on-black violence. Mm-hmm. So that's a menticidal process which sees us as the enemy, sees us as something that has no value, easy to destroy. You're not wasting anything if you kill another black person. It's amazing. I guess another example of that, when I see young black males on TV, you know, 16, 17, 18, and they have nines or what have you, and they're running from police who have the same, white police officers who have the same weapons, who have the same thing. So that psychological aspect is very, very important. If one man pulls a bullet and he shoots another man, that other man's probably going to die. If that other man shoots at you and bullet hits you, you're probably going to die. So what usually distinguishes who is going to pull the trigger and who is going to run and who's going to be seen as the stronger or the authority, that's all psychological. The same thing within these relationships. It's all psychological. So that racism as a component is primarily a psychological function, just like all the excuses that I analyze historically, culturally, socially, psychologically in this book. These are all psychological. I just fell in love. The idea that we need to create this gray race, and it's my mission, my job to bed a European and produce a child so that in the end we can get rid of racism by turning ourselves half European, half African, having no idea how long that would take and how many people would have to volunteer and how many people would have to find somebody who looked exactly the opposite of them in order to produce this race that is non-descriptive racially. Everybody looks the same. The idea of a better sexual fit, this one really tripped me out. I heard this in summer orientation for students who were going to college. And I was speaking to these students. I was talking to them about interracial coupling, and this one student stood up, and he said, "No, I read that white females, but particularly Asian females have a better sexual fit with black males than black females. And I really had to hold everything that I could to keep from laughing. And this other student, and I said, what? And this other student said, he said, yes, I heard the same thing. And I said, okay, well, where did you hear this? Oh, yeah, it was on Ricky Lake. And they're taking this as science. That's brainwashing. So all of these activities, all of these rationales that lead us to continue to be victims of racism in the bedrooms, in the streets, in the prisons, wherever, they're primarily psychological. It's not someone beating you upside the head to make you think this way. You're operating within a racist framework. You're playing out the role of the inferior in a situation of inferiors and superiors based upon race. The idea, the matriarchal complex, the idea that black women are so mean and aggressive that they run men away. Okay, now I question that based upon the women I've known in my life, and I've run into some rough women just like I've run into some rough men in terms of personalities. But within an oppressive system, within a racist system, within a system where women end up being the ones who have to take care of the children in most cases, I would expect to have or would expect that I should desire to have an African woman who is strong so that with the probability of black men dying, I know that they're being raised in the correct way by somebody who can defend them and can protect their interests. I want somebody who is strong. So they're using things that have been survival strategies, if you will, for us as accusations that make African women unfit for relationships. The idea that of scarcity and value. Robert Staples, who's a sociologist who I've lost an enormous amount of respect from with this as well as his appreciation of homosexuality. Robert Staples made the argument that white women are so much more desirable by black men because of their scarcity on the planet. So, like, things that are supposed to be more scarce are supposed to have a higher price. So diamonds are supposed to be, and of course they're not, their entry into the market is controlled, but diamonds are supposed to be so much more expensive because they are scarce on the planet, or antique cars are supposed to be more expensive because there are so fewer of them that are in working conditions. However, the problem is that where you find most of the interracial relationships, interracial coupling, these are in countries where Europeans are the majority. In these countries, the white women aren't the ones who are scarce, relatively speaking. The black women are the ones who are scarce in terms of sheer numbers. So the logic flies in the face of the worldliness of the black males who are chasing white females, because most of them don't really have an understanding of what's going on in this world and what has gone on interracially. We had the Eldridge Cleaver type mentality where he was making the argument that I'm going to get the white women, or the white girls, I'm going to rape them, I'm going to beat them, because that'll get back at the man for what he did to me, for what he did to us. Well, and I say, folks, you know, that's really major payback for that type of logic. I'm going to marry a white woman, white girl, white female. I'm going to have children with her. I'm going to give her and her family all my money. When I die, like when J.A. Rogers died and Helga Rogers kept the copyright and all the rest of that for his books and married a white male, and they're now living quite well off of the sale of J.A. Rogers' books, I'm going to really hurt these people by taking care of a daughter that no one else would take care of. I'm really going to get back at the man for doing this. The idea of proximity, these excuses that people use, and they make these theoretical arguments based upon it. The idea of proximity that I talked about at the beginning of the discussion. And it is a fact that most interracial couples, at least up until very recently, have located themselves on college campuses. So most of the people in the past who have been married met each other on college campuses because you had, you know, black male on a predominantly white campus or what have you. And they say that's the reason why you have more black males married to white females. The sad thing about this And obviously this is going to change a little bit in the future, but the sad thing about this excuse is that you have many, many more black females on predominantly white campuses than you have black males on predominantly white campuses. So why don't you have a larger number of black females married to white males on these campuses? Because you have more white females who are in close proximity to white males than you have black males who are in close proximity to white females. So why do you have many, many more black males married to white females than black females married to white males if proximity is a real argument? We have a lot of these excuses, and of course that's why the book was named Excuses, Excuses. We have a lot of these excuses that are put out as sound theory, as sound thinking, as sound evidence that this is something that makes sense when people are not considering the economic motivations, the economic forces at work, when they're not considering the political and military forces that are at work, when they're not considering history, especially the relationship between the mulatto population and I don't consider that to be a bad word, it's just a descriptive. People want to say biracial. That's a euphemism for something that is between two races, a product of that. Where you have the creation everywhere. There is not one single instance of European colonization, domination, except in cases of extermination. And then even there was rape, but there was not the opportunity for a buffer class to develop because the people were extirpated. They were killed off. There's no example of Europeans going out to colonize any place whatsoever where they did not immediately rape and produce a mulatto class, which they did then instill. Oh, there are examples where they also brought in people from other places, as in Azania, as in a number of countries on the continent where they brought in people from India, where they brought in people from Asia, and they gave these people positions of power. But still, even there, they went about the business of creating a mulatto class that would strengthen and support that Asian or Indian economic base for that middle and provide greater protection for them. So that's everywhere they've gone. And I, for the life of me, I can't understand why, if something has worked for them all this time, why they would change tactics in the middle of the road. That wouldn't make sense. What works, you continue to do.
Wow. Yeah, I just want to repeat that. I felt like I was saying this a lot at the White Privilege Conference, which is very much related to this discussion. That confusion is lethal, and that has been my observation of one of the key symptoms of non-white people who engage in sexual intercourse with white people: confusion. I created a little metaphor that I use to pick out, just as a reminder, of some of the symptoms that I tend to see from non-white people who are engaged in these tragic arrangements with white people. And it's sad. It's fitting, could not be better, sad. And the S is for creating space. And when I say that, these non-white people, they have to make space for white people who are not racist. They just have to. Any discussion of racism, it cannot be, you got to be suspicious of all white people. It can't be all white people directly, indirectly, consciously, unconsciously, are practicing racism, white supremacy. That cannot be. There have got to be some white people who are not racist. So creating space. The A is for abstract. They do not talk about racism, white supremacy as though it's white people going around doing things, whether it's lynching, whether it's the debacle that took place in Haiti with the earthquake, whether it's all of the problems that non-white people experience worldwide. It's got to be white people doing things that are making these problems. No, racism is systemic. It's infrastructure. It's just rules that have been in place. It's everything but the white guy sitting next to me, the white woman sitting next to me. The D, divided loyalties. Exactly what, pretty much what you discussed in terms of these folks not really being loyal to black people, non-white people, having to defend white people. And I got this directly from a non-white female, so-called Asian female, who writes about race on a college campus. She dot every I, cross every T. She hits all of your symptoms. She's on a college campus, a professor, writes about racism. She was going to be a guest on the program until she looked at my show page and saw that on the top of the show page, I say that I do not encourage, support, or participate in sexual intercourse between white people and non-white people. And she said she could not do the show because she's married to a white person. And she said, in quotes, I have divided loyalties. I just wanted to pitch that acronym to you to see if you've observed those same symptoms, if you think that's accurate. So SAD, space, abstract, and divided loyalties.
I agree 100%. You used the word SAD, and it rang an immediate bell. Malcolm X's favorite movie was Nothing But a Man, a movie called Nothing But a Man. And in there, the sister who's trying to there's this guy who works on the train, and he's got more money than the guys in town, and she's a preacher's daughter, and she's doesn't deal with any of the guys in town, obviously. And he comes and asks her out on a date, and while they're out, he's talking to her. He said, "You know, well, why did you come out with me? You know, I'm like one of these guys with a bad reputation from the railroad. Blah, blah, blah. Why would you come out?" She said, "The men in town, they're just so sad, and you seemed interesting. You seemed like, you know, somebody who I could talk to. And when we look around at these people in terms of their psychologies, we're looking at some very sad people, some very broke people, people who have no connection, so desperate for this love of another that everything flies out the window in terms of reason. This few bad apples argument I have heard so many times. That's probably the most common one in terms of the defense of individual Europeans. And that comes out of the context of us not understanding that we're at war. I understand that we're at war for the survival, for the mind, for the physical existence of African people. So I know that in war, soldiers are on each side, and these soldiers shoot at each other, and they try to kill each other. A soldier from one side does not go over to the other side to interview the soldiers on the other side to see which one is a good character and which one is a bad character. He shoots every single soldier that he sees on the other side. We are being asked to go and interview individuals within the people who have historically been about the business of destroying us instead of building up ourselves, strengthening ourselves to a point where we are powerful people. And then maybe, if that's what we feel like doing at that time, going over to interview to find out who we should do business with or who we should allow into this school or who we should what have you. But this is going backwards, and that's the mentality of people who are powerless. When you're dealing with people who do not feel that they're powerful, then they go to the people they consider to be powerful to try to get some of that power or to try to allow them to loan them some of that power so that they can do what they need to do. And that's pretty much in a nutshell, if you will, how so many Africans approach this. They know better than to say that there's something wrong with Europeans because they have such a vested interest in surviving. And to me, that's very much a slave mentality, the individualism that we have embraced that is seriously working to our disadvantage, a slave mentality. You know, you can have my wife, you can have my child, you can have my everything, you know, just let me live. And that mentality is one that makes a person rationalize everything that has happened in non-racial terms. I have an in-law who the first thing I was talking, explaining about the lynching of African people, and the first thing that she wanted to bring up was this one European. Out of these thousands of Africans who I was talking about who were being lynched, she wanted to make that one European be comparable in terms of balancing that out. So these people will look at that for that one example. And we finally have a black who they claim was a serial killer. So all of the serial killers throughout time, that tradition of serial killers that's extremely strong within European culture, within European society, that line of serial killers is somehow balanced out by this one black man who they say, and many people argue it was not him, who they say was a serial killer. So the process of normalizing, not even say making human, but normalizing Europeans and European behavior as our behavior makes it so that to accuse them of anything, to accuse us in the same way. So when you make what they have done and you try to find examples to make that us fit them, to find one African despot who killed a bunch of Africans in order to maintain his power and iron fist over his country, who was trained by Europeans, who thought like a European, who loved Europeans, that one individual makes normal what Europeans have been doing consistently everywhere they've been since the beginning of time. Okay, it's mind-boggling when you go to D.C., for example, and the number of black folks who want to take you to see the Jewish Holocaust Museum, where the maximum number of European Jews who were killed by their own brothers. So it's not, that wasn't genocide. Genocide is when one people attempt to remove another people from the planet. European Jews are Europeans. But even if we give them that, we're talking about 3 million. When I was young, that was the number, 3 million. Somehow it mushroomed up to 6 million, and even within that context, there wasn't a discussion of us and the differential treatment of Africans by their brothers, the Nazis. How do you compare 6 million Europeans, and we know more about that than anything, just like we know more about the Confederate leaders of the Civil War than we know about Nat Turner or Denmark Vesey or Gabriel Prosser or Bookman or Dessalines. But to compare that quote-unquote 6 million with 280 million Africans who were murdered in this process, this part of the Maafa. And we can use 280 million because we have to look at, as in fact, S.E. Anderson looked at that in his Black Holocaust for Beginners, even though I have some issues with that book because of the We're All Human perspective that runs through it. But when you do the calculations, you have to calculate the number of people that those people who were murdered would have produced. That's one of the errors that we make in terms of understanding, which makes it easier for us to allow the murder of a black male or a black female to not go too far except for a few tears, and then we've forgotten about it. When you kill, and Europeans are quite aware of this, when you kill one African who has yet to produce a child, then you kill everybody forever that person would have produced. And lineage grows exponentially. So that person might have produced 3 children. Those 3 children, along with someone, might have produced 12 children. Those children might have produced 24, might have produced on and on. So by killing that one person, you've removed every person that person was going to produce on this planet. We don't include that in our equations because we want to get the lowest possible number possible. We want to use the 10 or 11 million that the European scholars of our enslavement give, even though that is mind-boggling. What's his name in the Belgian Congo?
King Leopold?
King Leopold. He killed more Africans than European Jews were killed. He murdered more of us than were killed by European Jews than were killed by Hitler. Okay, he killed what, 10 million, and we still know more about. I have run into Africans who can tell you about Anne Frank, who can tell you about all of the movies, who can tell you about, you know, Auschwitz, who can tell you about the Munich, can tell you about all of these places, can tell you about the gas chambers, can tell you the stories, and all of these can tell you all these things, but cannot tell you one single thing about what Leopold did. And most don't even know Leopold's name. Don't know what happened. Don't know what happened in the quote-unquote Middle Passage. Don't know what happened during the coffin lines. Don't know what happened in the dungeons. Okay. Have absolutely no idea. Don't even have an awareness of the numbers of Africans who were murdered that European quote-unquote scholars give. So the menticide makes you downplay anything that points out Europeans as being evil in their thought and behavior. It makes you automatically deny that possibility. You immediately turn your face from whoever's saying anything that will make them into something that is undesirable. I remember talking to a relative, and I used the word enemy relative to Europeans, and this person literally cringed. I saw her physically draw up at the idea of even conceiving or having a discussion about Europeans as the enemy. So that's the level of menticide that exists in our community. When you are menticidal, you cannot see your destroyer as your destroyer. You see your destroyer as your lover. You see your destroyer as your savior. You see your destroyer as your validator. You see your destroyer as the person who you want to teach your children, who you want to go to bed with, who you want to feed you. Okay, if somebody's trying to kill you, then if you're intelligent, you don't eat the food that they put in front of you because you figure that there's some form of poison in there. So you don't eat the Cheetos. You don't eat, you know, the McDonald's. You don't eat those things because you can logically assume. And then, of course, you'll have those people, menticidal, who say, oh, well, white folks are eating, you know, that stuff too. But the number of them that are dying from it relative to us is extremely small proportionately. Okay? They also have the medical care. They also have the fruit. They're also changing their diets very rapidly, and our diets continue to move in this particular direction. So the menticidal person is going to rationalize that. The menticidal person is going to believe that the best possible thing that could happen to them is to be in proximity with white skin, with a white mind. Okay? And that white mind is going to be, if you will, their teacher, their tutor, their guide as to what they're supposed to think, how they're supposed to interpret reality, is supposed to check them, bring them back into line, protect them from those few bad apples that exist among white people. It's supposed to make him or her whole, supposed to make him or her human. And that, of course, I heard from a black male in grad school, one of the professors there. He was explaining how he married this white woman, and he was one of the authorities on race relations in this country, how he married this white woman because he wanted his children to have a better life. And he knew if they were lighter, they would have a better life. White folks know how bad it is. Andrew Hacker's Two Nations. In Two Nations, he talked about a study at the very beginning of the book. He talked about the study that they did among some college, white college males. And he said they brought them together into this space, and these official, you know, federal government agency guys came in and told them, you know, we made a mistake at your birth. We classified you wrong. You're not white. You are black. But since it is our mistake, we want to compensate for this. We know that we're wrong, so we want to compensate. We want to correct for this because you're going to have to live the rest of your life with everybody knowing that you're black. And they said, how much do you want in compensation for this? The lowest amount asked was $1 million because these students subconsciously or consciously understood what it was like to be black in America. And this is in the 70s or 80s. They were clear. This was in the 80s. They were clear. Subconsciously or consciously, the difficulty or how much compensation would have to be given to them if they were African, black in America. But menticidal people don't want reparations. Menticidal people, they say they, you know, they are fighting against it 190% because we've been given all that, you know, we should have been given and all the opportunities and all of the. How do you compensate for murder? There is, to my knowledge, in no society I know of, has there ever been a statute of limitations for murder. So what is the statute of limitations for the murder of 280 million people and counting? Because that was only from the that part of the mafia that involved our rounding up on the continent, being in the dungeons on the continent, being on the slavers, the ships, getting over here. That was not, that's not dealing with what happened on the plantations, lynching, quote-unquote civil rights, since then, prison industrial complex. That's only from that period of time. So that's 280 million and counting rapidly.
Wow. I just, I want to remind listeners, we had the suspected racist white supremacist known as Thomas Norman DeWolf on the program. His family, largest slave trader in New England by far. He was in a discussion about reparations, and there was a black, no one in the room, mostly white people, no one in the room opposed reparations except for two people. One of them was a black female. The other was a white man who, coincidentally, was her husband. This was on the program, read it directly out of the book, and they got video footage of this, too, of her reading off her list of reasons, excuses, if you will, as to why black people should not be given reparations, compensation for racism, white supremacy. Dr. Baroudi, I wanted to play this clip, and I'm going to check and see if Justice, if she has some more questions.
Okay.
I want you to listen to this clip. This is a former guest on the program, a black male who is married to a white woman, married to an admitted racist, excuse me. This person admitted to being a racist white supremacist. And he was, you know, explaining this relationship on the program. I just want to get your thoughts, knowing that this person is the founder of the White Privilege Conference. And I want to point out for everyone, I'm not picking on anyone. I suspect that this person is a victim of racism, white supremacy, and confused like myself about that system. However, the White Privilege Conference generates a lot of money is invested into this conference, hundreds of thousands of dollars, I suspect. And I think it's important that there be some scrutiny of what happens there. So I want to play this clip and just get your thoughts once you check it out.
Okay.
And it may be, and I'm not unwilling to look critically at this. It may be just a personal desire on my part to find a, you know, kind of soothing lotion so it doesn't feel so painful what it is that you're saying. So I'm not unwilling to look at that.
The soothing lotion was the white woman that he is now married. That was what he was referencing. Your thoughts on that? And again, this person, founder of the White Privilege Conference.
This is a black guy who's the founder?
Yes, sir. Black male.
Wow. I've been out of the loop. Wow. That is scary because I've heard of the conference and folks have been sending me emails and, you know, bits and pieces of this and that. But I didn't know. I wonder why no one brought that to my attention.
They might not know it.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that is the case. So some folks are going to know it now. it's always I'm listening to this. It's always the defense of these Europeans to try to soothe what? To try to make them comfortable. It's the job of the Negro, the job of the lost soul, but here it's the job of the Negro because Negroes are those who intentionally work against us. It's the job of the Negro to make Europeans comfortable with their oppression. That's their job. You will find them anywhere where we're at. You find someone who's making a statement that's the truth. You always find a Negro running up to the European trying to make him say, well, he didn't quite mean it like that, or I don't feel that way, you know, I'm one of your boys. Don't even, you know, worry about him. He's like on another planet. And then this Negro, of course, goes about the business of trying to destroy this African. And this, of course, gets him lots of kudos from Europeans and maybe a little more influence. But you're defending, if you are, I guess for me it's a simple equation. If you love, I'll use that word loosely, if you love, if you are sleeping with, if this is your life, okay, then you can't make that person uncomfortable. If they're the center, that's what Precious Chris Wilson was talking about when she said it doesn't make a difference who's physically on top in the bed when you have a white female and a black male or white and black. It's the white person who's on top in that bed. It's the white person who's in charge of that situation. Even if the black person thinks that they're leading. It's like the people who There's this saying, and really it shouldn't be said in this context, but it fits in terms of the intent, where I was told a long time ago, and I find it to be truthful, and I find it to be quite interesting. I like the idea of this in terms of what is thought and how intelligent our sisters are. It says that a man chases a woman until she catches him. And you have a situation where you have these black males who think that they're chasing these white females. And she's the one who says yes. That's something that has changed, like I said before. You've had black males chasing all of this time. But the woman is the one who says, yes, I will, or accepts the proposal. Okay? And I don't care how liberal we want to say people have gotten. In the vast majority of cases, it's still the man who asks the woman to marry him. So you're now having white women who are saying yes, who are allowing this to occur. So they're chasing these white women, and they think that they are the ones who are winning something. They are gaining a prize. The white females are gaining a prize. They have decided who, out of whatever black males are chasing them, they're going to have, based upon whatever qualities they have, based upon whatever assets, based upon the mentality, based upon the level of menticide in that individual, based upon how much they love whiteness. And they pick and choose based upon that. He's not the one making the choice. Just like with the black females and the white males, she's not the one making the choice. In this case, it's because this individual stooped down low enough to ask you in the racist mind of America. This individual is giving you an opportunity to be with him. He's giving you an opportunity to be part of this great American or new European adventure that he and his boys are in charge of. And they're allowing you in. Okay? First row seats. So the him saying that fits just the general idea of the attitude of Africans who are married to Europeans. Their goal is to please that European. They don't want anything to upset that European. And it says something to me about this white woman. I mean, it's like when people are, you know, married for a long time. Well, I shouldn't even say a long time. If this is a serious thing, then very seldom do you find major differences in the politics of the spouses. You might find a little difference on that candidate, a little different, but usually, in terms of the general interpretation of society, how things are supposed to work, concepts of democracy, capitalism, sexism, all the rest of these things, the pair think along the same lines. So if he is a black male who has created this, you know, white supremacy conference.
White privilege conference. White privilege.
You have to put it in the right terms. Privilege conference. Then that says a lot to me about her in terms of how she thinks. So she has, this is, many people would say this is her agenda, and she's found someone who can articulate it well for her because he's not the one that's in charge in the relationship. She is. She has a powerful people behind her. I remember sitting on Morehouse's campus in my vehicle, waiting for the wife to come out from her class, and I'm watching the guard at the front gate that's allowing people in. And every car that was driven by an African person, unless it was a faculty or, you know, somebody new, everyone was stopped, checked, asked where he was going. Let me see your student ID. Let me see your driver's license. Blah, blah. Each student was stopped. Whenever a European came to the gate, the question was, where are you trying to get to? Can I get you directions? You know, where do you need to park at? And there was no one there standing there telling this person to do that. He hadn't read a manual on this. He understood that if he treated this European incorrectly, in addition to just the awe of being having the privilege of speaking to a European, but he understood that if he did something incorrect with this European, he had a whole people behind him or her, and it could seriously damage him. But the concept in terms of African people relative to our power, there's no fear there, because you can do what you want to an African, and there's not going to be any retaliation, not any meaningful retaliation. People often forget, and they will find all ways to rationalize and get around this. We get excited when people win court cases because of police brutality, or police shot this person's child, blah, blah, blah. And I am, you know, glad that this person is given money in response to that, even though we know that that does not compensate for the death of a loved one. But we have to realize these things occur in predominantly black areas. And in these predominantly black areas, the African people there are the primary taxpayers. So the money that goes to pay this individual for the loss of their son by someone who was a police or what have you, that either comes either directly through the tax monies gained from the African people who live there, because these people aren't coming out of their pockets, and the people who do the shooting aren't going to lose their jobs or have to pay for this in any form of compensation, or the money that was collected from the taxpayers was used to pay off the monies for the insurance to pay for this. So it's sort of that warped thing where there are questions that we don't ask because it'll speak directly to how racist this system is and how deeply it's embedded in our logic to allow it to operate in the same way and to rationalize it. Very few people even, you know, talk about or think about or ask that question of where does that money come from. So it's like we're paying for other people having killed us. Not only are we paying through the death of our sons intentionally and death of our daughters intentionally, we're paying the money that the families get for that intentional death. The white community doesn't suffer in any way, shape, form, or fashion, and every one of the people who does this is rewarded by the white community. You don't hear stories about white folks who were in the police or what have you who killed a black person who, you know, spends the rest of their life unemployed because they can't get a job anywhere. They get a job in the private sector. They get a job in another police department in another city or another county. But the brother who told on Nixon and said that the wiretapping was going on in Watergate,
yes, sir.
He spent the rest of his life in misery. He spent the rest of his life in misery. Unemployed, turned to alcohol, you know, died because he was going to be punished. He was going to be punished, just like Haiti continues to be punished because of how victorious they were against these Europeans and what they did to these Europeans. There's people need to read Jacob Carruthers' The Irritated Genie. And they can see the story about what our brothers did as warriors to a people who had been violently. But the average lifespan of an African in Haiti from his arrival as a slave was 7 years. That was the average lifespan of an African who arrived on the island of Haiti and was a slave. 7 years. But we're trying to apologize for Europeans today, trying to make them into some kind of human being. Our ancestors understood that being a human was a result of how you acted. It was your character. You weren't born a human being per se. You weren't born a person. This was something that you grew into. You molded yourself in a particular way. So you had people who wouldn't become people, if you will, wouldn't become humans because they didn't act like humans. But because we operate in this system which validates them, we're operating on the principle that everybody is born naturally with this quality and they don't have to prove anything. And we're suffering as a result of that. Misdefinitions.
Wow. Again, pleasure to have him on the program. Second time. Dr. Mwali Mukay Baruti. Justice, if you are there, if you have some other questions you would like to ask, go right ahead. Your microphone is open.
I don't have any questions right now, but I just want to say thank you from earlier. Thank you for what you said about, like, what type of books there is.
And, Sister Justice, I wanted to say, and I sincerely mean this, my wife and I have a school in our home, and we have 4th through 12th graders. Most of them are, like, 4th through 8th and 9th grade now, and that's generally what we have, which, you know, we like. But we've had this school for 11 years now, and it's always more than wonderful. And I need you to understand this. It's always more than wonderful when you have a child who understands or who wants to understand what happened to African people and the kind of character that they should develop as a warrior in training. Our school is called Akabin Institute. Akabin is a symbol, an Adinkra symbol, that's a war horn. And the Akabin was what was blown by special people in the community when it was time for people to come together because they had to go to war. There was a big decision that needed to be made, but it's primarily called the war horn. And that's why we call this our school that, because we feel that it's our job to educate the children so that they will know what their responsibility is and so that they will know the enemy when they see it, so they will not be destroyed or caught up in the rapture of insanity. So I appreciate the fact that you are on here. This is 10 years, what have you. This is a brave act on your part to come on here and do this at this age. It's like Autumn Ashanti was, what, 7 or 9 years old when she said the poem that made it so that the public school system, New York, wherever it was, Brooklyn, what have you, in New York, banned her from even coming back because she spoke truth. So you're at an age, and I'm so glad that you are curious about your people and your responsibility, and you have a special privilege. I would ask you, and as Brother Gus, if he has the opportunity, there's an essay in a book I wrote entitled Menticide, and the essay is entitled Groundings with My Daughters. And I want you to get that essay, and that's, you will be able to read it easily. I want you to get that essay and read it and understand that it is for sisters like you, okay?
Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
That essay, is it Groundings with My Daughters?
Groundings with My Daughters, and it's in the Menticide book. It's one of the essays in the Menticide book. And in fact, we're doing adult education here, and we'll be talking about that next Tuesday night here in this house. But it's written for our daughters. It's written for those who may or may not have a great deal of understanding, but they're trying to get it or they haven't recognized it yet. And it's me, if you will, as a responsible father, warrior scholar, talking to them about who they are and what they're supposed to be about and why.
I need to read that myself.
Mothers love it. I've encountered a number of, it's always surprising to me how what I write affects people. I'm not used to that, but it's always surprising to me how people respond. And mothers have responded to two things unbelievably. That's that essay in the complementarity book. That's amazing.
All of these books, as well as Excuses, and Homosexuality and the Feminization of African Males, all of these books are available at akabinhouse.com. Again, if you're listening here at Blog Talk Radio, just click Dr. Baruti's name, and it'll take you right to the page, and you can support excellent material, akabinhouse.com. Dr. Baruti, are you okay taking a few questions?
Yes, I can take a few questions.
Okie dokie. I'm going to try to go right down the list. Please try not to have background noise so we can preserve the quality of the broadcast. I'll start out, Non Mighty Wick and Tater Pie, both of you all are on. If you have questions you'd like to ask Dr. Baruti, please go right ahead.
No.
Okay.
Hello?
Non Mighty Wick, did you have any questions you wanted to ask?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Loud and clear.
Yes.
I could have heard incorrectly, Dr. Baruti, but I believe on the last time you were on the cows, I heard you make mention of a mandate to spoil kids or mandate to spoil your kids.
Yes.
If you did indeed say that, can you give me, you guess, a little bit more information on what you mean when you say that? And
certainly. And there's a chapter in the Children's Called the Homo book that talks about spoilage. This goes back to Doc Spock's baby book, which came out in the, you know, the 50s or 60s period. And there was in there, the directives that most of us followed, that, well, most of the parents followed, about the problem of, quote-unquote, stifling the children by not allowing them to do everything and to make decisions for themselves and to not provide guidance and to stay out of their personal space and all the rest of that. What this set us up for, and my mother, I guess she put it in a nutshell when she said, you don't spoil a child who's going to grow up in a society that's going to try to kill him. This set our children up because it took away their sense of discipline. It took away their ability to withstand the destruction of white supremacy. It made them think that we already were a powerful people within this cultural context. It moved them toward individualism. Spoiled people don't have a sense of community or a sense of working in the direction of a nation, particularly if the nation they consider themselves or might consider themselves to be a part of is powerless, because spoilage breeds an intense sense of individuality. The spoilage that we have continued to participate in is one that makes parents feel bad or deficient if they don't give their child everything that they need. So this, you end up in a situation where you are economically disadvantaged, but because you don't tell your children and can't tell your children what to do because you've allowed that control to be taken away from you, that you have to buy your children's behavior. You have to buy your children's agreement with what you want them to do. And in a situation where you don't have the kinds of resources that other people do, who are spoiling their children, if you will, but these children, of course, are going to take over and rule, but you don't have the kind of resources to get them the things that they want to, you're eventually going to have your children turn against you. The children also see how weak you are, because children are constantly trying to figure out how to get and hold power, which is, it's only logical, because they want to do what they want to do. That's what children do. And that's why you have parents and guardians whose job it is to make them understand the difference between want and need, to make them understand the importance of developing a good character, all the rest of those things. That's another major thing that was taken out of our community with the increase of spoilage, where the development of character was left to the media, was left to the schools, was left to a church that is very money-focused. In our traditions, and you can read this virtually anywhere, when you're talking about people who write about traditions, character was the first thing that African people developed in their children. That was the main and most important thing in the development of a child, the development of good character. And we left that to chance. We have, because of this, we have children who are in charge. And there are many things that children don't know. They have to learn. There are things that I don't know now that someone who is 20 years older than me, who's, you know, 75, 80 years of age, can correct or check me on or teach me, because I haven't experienced those things. Therefore, I haven't accumulated the knowledge or the wisdom that would allow me to understand this situation well. But within this context, African people allowed this European logic, this Eurasian, to relinquish control over the socialization of their children, what was a part of that, what was involved in that, or control over who their children associated with, control over what was on the in the media. We forget that anyone brought up in any society is going to be socialized within that social context. You are going to be socialized. So when African parents relinquish control of the socialization of our children to the media, to other things, then someone else was socializing our children. So the values that they came to hold, the character that they had, those things that they wanted and demanded were coming from someone else. And now we're surprised that this has happened. We're surprised. I'm not surprised when children turn on parents, when they turn on adults, not only because they recognize their powerlessness, but because they have been raised to think that they know everything when they are young. The biggest problem that I have heard from elders and educators in the community is that the children today, and we recognize that these children did not raise themselves, so this is not a blaming statement. The children today cannot take criticism. They cannot take instruction because they have been raised in a culture that has made them believe that they know everything.
Yep.
So you have a reversal versus in the African tradition, you go from information to knowledge to wisdom. Because I've watched a little Jerry, and because I've watched a little BET, then I'm wise. I don't have to listen to anybody. I don't. Just because you're older doesn't mean that you're smarter than me. I've had children attempt to argue with me. I remember Marimba Ani went on campus one day to speak to explain her writings and what she was talking about in terms of African spiritual system, and she had freshmen who wanted to stand up and shout her down. This woman has been, you know, working on this study for probably longer than their parents have been on the planet. But because of the nature of this society, and that leads to something else which is, to me, extremely important. In that situation, anybody's opinion is correct. That allows European behavior to become a normal and natural part of African people, because you can't argue that something is African. That's just your opinion. You can't argue even through proof that something is European, because that's just your opinion. Okay, so that really was initiated, was accelerated through the spoilers. It was initiated through the process or the desire to be integrated into European society, but it was very rapidly accelerated through the spoilage process. And the that part of the process has allowed children to be put in the hands of people who are homosexual by nature, I argue, and that being them and them wanting to be normalized globally, meaning they have to homosexualize the people on the planet, then you deal with the children. So you take them away from their parents, control away from the parents, and then you socialize them in a homo-friendly or homosexualized way. So when that group of children become adults or old enough to be adults and they have children, well, they're going to raise them up in that way. And pretty soon the way of their parents and their grandparents and their ancestors will have been forgotten, because there's no one teaching them that, no one telling them that, no one instructing them, and no models of that.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes.
I have one other question. You mentioned that you do a homeschool program.
Yes.
I was wondering what materials do you use, and if they're available online, and if you can give me a little more about what your curriculum looks like.
Okay. I'll take you through one day real quick. The children arrive from 8:30 to 9:00. They play chess. I think chess is extremely important. I know that it is also a product of African people, so I'm teaching them something that is theirs, or they're learning something that is theirs. Chess has this way of calming down and getting the mind focused on thinking as a process, and that's something we really focus on here, not only just our traditions, but also the thinking process, which is something which has been removed from our children. They've equated thinking with work, and then work has been associated with being inferior, and that's something that you don't want to do, so everybody wants to get over. Disconnect between work and product. At 9 o'clock, they read for an hour, something that we have that we think that they need to read often because it's associated with a need that they have. So we might have someone who is spoiled and doesn't realize how good his situation is, so we might have him read something about somebody who had a difficult time, like the Antoine Fisher story. Some sisters who don't understand the nature of being a revolutionary or how good their life is, we might have them read Asada. Some guy who doesn't understand about gang activity, what have you, they might read Monster. We might have them read, Browder's books. It depends upon their age and what their need are. But all of these books are by us and for us. We want to make sure that they stay connected with our writers. After that, there's usually a quote and proverb by us, for us, put on the board. And often that's connected to something that went right or something that went wrong. In school or that morning, or a parent said, you know, something that needed to be checked on, and the quote and proverb, they have to explain what they mean. And this is critical important, and it should help us understand why proverbs was so much of a critical part of the education of African people. Proverbs make you think. So you have to imagine the level of intellectual development of children in African communities where proverbs just came at you left and right constantly all the time, and you enjoyed this learning process and explaining and thinking process. It was enormous compared to what we see today. After that time, depending upon the day, there will be our story, math, you know, science, or what have you, and then we go through a regular school day. But everything here is taught from the African perspective. I just put on Facebook an advertisement from a brother who volunteers and does math here from an African perspective. He explains what African math is and why it was used, how it was developed, what it was about. So this is what they get. They get this from their center. Everything that we talk about is analyzed from an African center perspective. There are a number of books, but really what is important is the parent understanding that even though they may think that they're not qualified, the child is going to take them or teach them or show them or ask them what they don't understand and what they don't know, which is going to tell you what you need to go and dig and find out. Usually parents who do this, who want to do this, they have a degree of centeredness, those who we're talking about who are conscious people, they have a degree of centeredness, so they're going to be explaining things in a particular way, and they've probably been explaining it to that child or those children for a long time anyway. But those who fear that they're not qualified, the children are going to tell you what you need to read, what you need to deal with. I am primarily the Our Story teacher and the science teacher. The required text here for Our Story is a book entitled Our Story by Gaidi Farak, and it's listed on our website. You can get it from there. A lot of the discussion that comes in here is taken out of Browder's Now Valley Contributions to Civilizations. It's taken out of Journey of the Songhai People. I pull from all kinds of sources. Del Jones, I mean the John G. Jackson, bits and pieces of what they can understand and bringing it all together to make sense for them. And that's not a difficult task to do. If you use this book, Our Story, or whatever book that you want to, if you use that as the base of teaching Our Story, which is only one part of what you teach, then you can pull from all the other things that you have read to give them a well-rounded understanding. You go to Renoko Rashidi's sites. He has these, you know, two, three-paragraph or two, three-page essays on all kinds of things that Africans have done and are a part of throughout our history. So you can pull from that and go from there. You've got the RBG site where he has numerous articles that folks can listen to. We have Music Appreciation Days where they get acquainted with Gil Scott-Heron, where they get acquainted with the Last Poets, where they get acquainted with a lot of people that they haven't heard of. Some of them haven't heard of Dead Press. So they get acquainted with these people on these special occasions. And, of course, there are always events. And if it's done correctly, then you're going to find that there are other schools that or homeschoolers who are doing the same thing that are more than willing to hook up with you. So for a lot of people in these places, even when they have quote-unquote African-centered schools, some of them aren't African-centered schools, so it's something that we need to do for our children. We know our children aren't being corrected, taught correctly.
Then we know that we have to go about the business of doing that. There are an enormous amount of resources. For boys who are of age, they read Asafo, and we sit down and we have talk about it. There should be a rites of passage program associated with the institution that you're involved with, even if the institution is only three people. And there should be a rites program where the girls, separately from the guys, learn those things that taught to African women in training and African men in training. I guess also at the core of that, we know what the public school system in this county requires at the different grade levels. So they're taking these things, but from the African center. So for a child who's supposed to be taking geometry at this grade, assuming that he's ready for geometry, or assuming that he hasn't passed geometry already, and we don't hold them back and we don't push them forward based upon what the school system said, we teach them where they're at. They get that, and it's discussed. So they might have to read Georgia history, but there is a discussion going on the entire time about what is wrong with the book that they're reading and how it is incorrect in its interpretation. So they become very critical in their reading also. So there's a great interactive process, and you'd be surprised at the people who come to assist. We have a father who is bartering two of his sons here. He is a professional gardener, so the children now have a garden in the backyard. He was just here today. They're working on collards and lettuce and some other kind of kale in the backyard. So there's a huge garden in the backyard, and he comes and teaches them about worms and the chemical content in the soil and all the rest of these things. And he brings in, and they have to do this in the garden. And we have another father here who is a home builder, and he has two of the boys in doing carpentry with him. So the school, we have to understand that it's not just, let's say, here at this house. The school is all of the community that's involved. So you'll find people bringing you DVDs. You'll find people bringing you books. You'll find people doing things for you because they want to have these children educated correctly once they see that you're doing the work.
Thank you again for the constructive information.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Oh, and also if there are particular questions, I don't have a problem with being contacted by email. That's been the case a lot of times. And if there are, like, particular questions, email them to me, send them to me on Facebook, or send me an email, and I will answer to the best of my ability.
Hello?
Okay. I'm here. Hello?
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I'm not sure what happened. But you weren't supposed to be able to hear me, but it sounds like Gus is tied up, so I'll go ahead and ask you a question, actually.
Okay.
Hang tight. I got that corrected. Thank you. Hang tight.
All right.
I just wanted to double check with your time, Dr. Baruti, to make sure we're not holding you up.
I'm looking at the clock now. I have about 10 more minutes.
Okay. Outstanding. Yeah, because folks called in. Go right ahead, 310.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Gus. I had a question for you, Doctor. You said a lot about non-white people in sexual relations with white people. Very much so. I wanted to ask you a even more pinpointed question, and I want to say before I ask it, I'm not at all trying to alienate any types of people when I ask it, but I do feel like it's an important question for African Americans. With regard to specifically African Americans, do you think that it is do you see that it is constructive, destructive, or neutral, or any comments you have about African Americans engaging in sexual relations with non-black, non-white people, and does that relate to perpetuating the sort of caste-like system that we have?
Well, logically, I'm going to say that I have to look at this at the broader societal or group level or national level. Your power is a function of your people. The reason why a lot of what we quote-unquote gained during the civil rights, black power movement, wasn't necessarily because of what was going on here, is because of Europe and the U.S. were losing its colonial hold over Africa, and they were afraid how Africans would respond with how we were being treated over here, them being the motherland. The Japanese who received reparations for the internment during World War II didn't receive those reparations from Los Angeles, the state of California, and the U.S. government because of their protests. There was very little protest. They received that because of little protest and because the United States had become a debtor nation to Japan. So we have to look at this in the context. If we want to do this in this real objective, you know, sort of sterile fashion, we have to do this in terms of looking at it from the national level. What nations of people are not in the process of exploiting African people? If there are nations of people, or there is a nation of people that's not exploiting African people, and in fact is allied with African people, relative to our empowerment, relative to the security of African people globally, because I don't think we can limit it to African people in this country, then I wouldn't have a problem with that. Okay, but as long as your people at a national level are about the business and have historically been about the business of exploiting African people, then there shouldn't be those kind of alliances, because that is very destructive in terms of the relative power of the groups and your contribution to them. When there are people who are exploiting African people, the resources of the African person in the relationship, they tend to be siphoned into the community of the more powerful nation. The resources of the individual from the more powerful nation does not have, or there isn't any evidence that their resources get siphoned into the community of the less powerful person. It's always the other way around, just like stores in our communities. That money isn't being redistributed into our community, is being extracted and taken to other communities. These are exploitative situations, with us being the ones who are exploited. So when I'm looking at that, then that to me is the most important variable, not on whether this will make good relationships between this neighborhood and that neighborhood, whether this is going to make America this quote-unquote multicultural, which is a whole other discussion, place, but on the relationship of that individual or couple's relationship to the relationship of the two nations. And I have just about run out of time here.
Oh, outstanding. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us. Always feel like I learned tons having you on the program. Again, I hope everybody, if you please, if you're listening at Blog Talk Radio, please, AkobenHouse.com. The address again, AkobenHouse.com. com. I will definitely make sure that Justice gets your contact information so you have her email address. You can get her that information. And I just want to give a sincere thank you. We have a ton of gratitude here at the COWS for being able to have you on the program twice this year. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us, and I definitely look forward to being in contact with you soon, sir.
I appreciate being here, and I enjoyed myself again immensely. So I look forward to the next contact. And, of course, every situation I get into, I try to learn, and I definitely learned something today. Well, more than a few things. I learned some things today. Okay? So give the family our greetings, and we look forward to the next event.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you again, and we learned a lot as well, sir. Take excellent care, and we will be in touch soon.
All right. You too.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, Justice, our guest, Dr. Mwalimu K. Baruti, his second trip to the context of white supremacy. Thank you all for tuning in, sharing constructive information. I hope you got constructive information, your time here on the program. If not, hopefully you didn't waste your time. You were here for 5 minutes. This is not constructive. Moving on to something else. That is what I hope for all the folks who tune into the COWS. If it's not constructive, find something else. Next program is tomorrow. We'll be right back, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific. I think you heard Dr. Baruti speak a lot today about how racism, white supremacy, is mostly conducted at a psychological level. I think Mr. Fuller, he talks about the number one tactic of racism, white supremacy being deception. Our guest for tomorrow, that's what he does all of his research on. He does CDs, audio CDs, and research on mind control in America. Stephen Jacobson, he is a white man, but that is what all of his research is about, how thought perception is controlled and manipulated as a form of mistreatment. That is what his research is on. He will be here tomorrow. And I hope you will find the relevance of this information, particularly based on what Dr. Baruti continued to hammer home today about mythicide, confusion, and psychological warfare, which tied also directly into Dr. Ashanti when he was on the program, and he talked about brainwashing, brain trashing, if you will, and how it is only successful if the victim is unaware that this has been done to them. So I hope the program tomorrow will be very relevant, very constructive. Again, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, Stephen Jacobson tomorrow on the COWS. Dr. Martin Kevorkian, third trip this weekend. It's not entered in the computer yet because I just got back from the White Privilege Conference yesterday. So I'm trying to keep up and get on the grind. But Dr. Martin Kevorkian, third trip this weekend. That'll be Saturday. He mentioned the book. I thought that was pretty wild. Irritated Genie, I spoke with him yesterday. He shared some constructive information, and he will be making his return trip on Memorial Day, May 31st. He'll be back. Second trip on the program. Very much looking forward to having him back on the program to chat more. He did seem, when I spoke with him yesterday, he did seem like he appreciated the program. So that'll be cool to have him back as well, and rather quickly. Other than that, oh, Justice, email.
justice.asap@yahoo.com. Again, justice.asap@yahoo.com.
Outstanding. Did you want to share anything about the program, anything you heard, or anything else you wanted to let the listeners know?
This is a great show, and I did write about a half a page of my notes and what I thought about Dr. Baruti.
I would love to hear what notes you took, if you would like to share.
Okay. Dr. Baruti seems really informed about racism, white supremacy. His book sounds really interesting. Excuses, excuses. He teaches a homeschool program. This is my first time doing the show with Dr. Baruti. Dr. Baruti, say, white people have been seen as the most beautiful. White people are in every media. White people couldn't fit in the right category, and racism, white supremacy is not funny. Everything that Dr. Baruti said is true. My Non Mighty Wick asked two questions on the Cows radio show to Dr. Baruti. One of the questions that Non Mighty Wick asked was about what curriculum in the homeschool program do you do?
Excellent notes. Excellent notes. Sounds like you were paying attention during the program. Wow. Right on. I dig it. I wish more folks that Tater Pie has said that consistently. This program, and I suspect most programs that deal with counter-racism, whether it's Cree or Mr. Edward Williams at counter-racism.com, Hakima's program, if it's dealing with racism, white supremacy, you probably want to pay attention. Take notes. You might need to listen to it once or twice, maybe even five times, to really process the information. So it sounds like Justice was not playing video games, messing around. She was paying attention, taking notes, and trying to get as much constructive information as possible. Somebody sent me in a question. The question is, what is the most helpful way that a non-white, non-black female mother can, I guess, do for the black children she is raising? Wow, that is an interesting question. I wish you'd had a moment to get that one. I will email Dr. Baruti this question. I'll read it again so folks can hear it. The question is, what is the most helpful way or ways that a non-white, non-black female mother do to aid black children she is raising? Excellent question. I will email that to Dr. Baruti, and I will read his answer to that question on the program. I will do that today. Excellent question. Wish we had more time to get to that one, but I will email it to him and see what his response is. I'll share. I'll make sure I share with everybody else. Thank you, everybody, for calling in. I know we had a full switchboard, and everybody did not get to ask a question. Actually, I'm not going to apologize for that. I do feel you. I feel you calling in, and you didn't get to ask your question or what have you. I almost didn't take any callers today at all because people acted a fool when Tim Wise was on the program on Easter Sunday, jumping up and down and getting an attitude because they couldn't ask questions. And someone even had the audacity to get angry because Justice was on the program. Last I checked, Gusty Renegade is running this program. If I don't want to take any callers, we might not take any callers. It almost happened to Jay just because I do remember the conduct that was demonstrated when Tim Wise was here. So keep that in mind when you're listening here at the Cows. I don't have to take calls at all. I did want to say this because this was in his book as well. He pointed out that white supremacy cannot prevail without continuing to put an incredible amount of energy in conditioning everyone to see white as the most high, most beautiful thing that you could ever desire on the planet. He says that in the book, that white supremacy could not be maintained if that were not the case. If that is true, I think that would be extraordinary grounds to discontinue sexual intercourse with white people. Just on that grounds alone, make every effort to denigrize yourself from finding white people as attractive. And one of the main things I do to help with that is to consistently make sure I reference white people as, at minimum, suspected racists, at minimum. And I mean, that is a high level of suspicion. That's not just words. That means I think this person is most likely a racist. That's what I think of when I think of white. As I said, everybody at the White Privilege Conference, even Dr. Moore, who's married to an admitted racist, conceded white means racist. That was easily conceded at the White Privilege Conference, which was a bastion of confusion. That was easily conceded and unopposed by white people and non-white people at the conference. So keep that in mind. I don't care who the white person is, how cute you think they are. I see white people that I think are cute. This is what I say. Oh, that is a cute suspected racist. That keeps me focused. That keeps my frame of mind correct so that I'm not off in la-la land as we all have been conditioned to be. Cute suspected racist. Handsome suspected racist. That's what I keep in mind. And that way I found if I come in contact with them, if I have that in mind, invariably, they're going to do something racist, I'll catch it. I'll be paying attention. I'll be alert. I'll catch it. And that, see, I expected you were going to do that. That's why I was thinking of you as a suspected racist. I have found when you're not thinking in that way, white people get to do all kinds of things, practice racism consciously, unconsciously, and non-white people, because we're not looking for it, we let it ride. We're accustomed to being mistreated all the time. The menticide Dr. Baruti spoke about, we let it ride all too often. That's why Tim Wise is so effective, because we don't see him, we don't think, racist. We just see him and think, oh, that is the greatest white Jesus Savior in the world. Oh, if I could just touch the hem of his garment, I would be blessed and never wash my hand again. I don't think of Tim Wise that way. I think of him as a racist. I think of him as David Duke. I think of him as any other racist white supremacist. That's why I catch the things that he does on this program when he keeps saying fair, when he references Dr. Welsing's work as pseudoscientific bullshit, and the myriad of other things that he's demonstrated on the program. And he'll be back April 25th. Make sure you tune in. Looking forward to that. At any rate, yep, I agree wholeheartedly with Tater Pie. Just letting white people talk, their racism will show, for sure. For sure. You can wait on that. That's like the sun. It's going to happen. All you got to do is sit back, put your feet up, and wait. It's coming. It's coming. That's going to wrap us up today. I'm still sick. I listened to the program from the White Privilege Conference, and I still sound horrible. And I am. I'm still congested and everything. So hopefully I will be healed before the next program. I'm tired of sounding all nasally on the program, so I can have my voice back that everybody loves. Cree's program with Dark Matter, that will be this weekend. Make sure you check that out, April 18th, Dark Matter, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific, Dark Matter on Counter-Racist Evolving Engineers program. Make sure you check her out all the way from the U.K. Should be a hoot. And again, like I said, we'll be back tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific, right here on The Cows. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Please support Back of the Buses blog, nonwhitealliance.wordpress.com. One more time, nonwhitealliance.wordpress.com, and Cree's blog as well, Cree7.wordpress.com. One more time, cree7.wordpress.com. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to the broadcast last week from the White Privilege Conference. Hope this program was constructive. We will be back this weekend. And the cows, I can't really say this is water to wine. Can't make that claim, but I can say this is 120 programs with no phone and no computer. And that's for all the people who gripe and complain. Let me see what you do. If you got a phone and computer, let me see what you can produce, and then we'll make a comparison. Gus T. Renegade, Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, and Justice. Make sure I don't forget the email again, justice.asap@yahoo.com. One more time, justice.asap@yahoo.com. We'll be back tomorrow. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Stay out of white people's bedrooms, gosh, and keep them out of your bedroom. No sex with white people under any circumstances. Thank you. We'll be back tomorrow.